On Their Feet, a Daredevil fic written and read by
Striped Scribe
and 42 Do Not Panic. Summary: A Murdoch never stays down, Foggy said, looking over the painfully small group of people sitting in the chapel. That's what Matt lived by. Be it in the boxing ring, after a failed exam, or even one of the admittedly too many times we were out at night strolling through the city and drinking too much cheap beer. He never stayed down. A Murdoch never stays down, Jack muttered through the tears, dragging himself from the couch to tend to a screaming baby. A Murdoch never gives up.
Chapter 1. A Murdoch never stays down, Foggy said, looking over the painfully small group of people sitting in the chapel. That's what Matt lived by. Beat in the boxing ring after a failed exam, or even one of the admittedly too many times we were out at night, strolling through the city and drinking too much cheap beer. He never stayed down. He tried to give his speech a more humorous note, but it was mostly so that he had even a chance to get through it without starting to cry again. Matt Murdoch was a lot of things. Foggy glanced around the funeral guests. His family was there. They'd taken Matt in like he was their own child from the very first time he had brought him home. He was smart, he was kind, and he had a big heart. But most of all, he was the best friend I could have wished for. Foggy knew the father was working with the orphanage Matt had grown up in, and he recognised two of the nuns as the ones who had collected the few belongings Matt had brought to the dorm the day after he had died. Matt was a lot of things. One of the only things he was not was a quitter. Between the nuns, Foggy spotted a handful of older kids, some teenagers, and two boys that were about Matt's age. He never talked a lot about his childhood, but the things he did talk about, it was easy to figure out that his life had never been smooth sailing. None of them looked like they were missing him particularly much. Between growing up without his mother, barely scraping by more often than not, and in the end, losing both his sight, and less than a year later, the only blood relative he had ever known, that mantra battling Jack taught his son must have been more important to him than most of us can imagine. On the other side of the small chapel were a few fellow students. He knew Marcy had made them be there, and it hurt just thinking about it. More important than I can imagine, for sure. There was only one other person in the room. A young woman, draped from head to toe in clothes that were so elegant they rivaled Marcy's on her best days, hiding behind dark sunglasses and an almost comically big hat. But this makes it even more painful that he had to die at such a young age. Foggy only realised he'd started crying when he looked down at his notes and noted the spots where tears were dissolving the ink. He blinked against the tears in his eyes, taking a deep breath to try and keep his voice steady. Matt was just 21 years old, and I'd only known him for less than 3 years, but even in that short time I learned more about him than I know about some of my closest childhood friends. I guess, in some ways, that is unavoidable when living together in 130 square feet for so long. Foggy threw an apologetic glance in Brett's direction, but his childhood neighbour had just offered him a gentle smile, a smile that Foggy hadn't seen on him in many years. I know Matty liked his coffee with a dash of milk in the mornings, but with sugar in the afternoon. He had written some things into the speech that he knew wouldn't mean a lot to the people listening to him, but that he couldn't leave out for his own sake. I know that he would eat almost anything that was served in the dining halls on campus, as long as it was hot and had at least some kind of nutritional value, which, if you've seen what they serve us there, is not always the case. Foggy knew that humour wasn't enough to stop himself from crying anymore, but he didn't have the energy to say anything but the words he'd written down. But if he had a choice and the money to spare, Matt was actually pretty picky about what he liked and what he would eat. I know what laundry detergent he liked to use, and I know what movie would always make him feel better when he was overwhelmed. He had read every guide and every tip on how to write a eulogy for your best friend that he could find. All of them said you weren't supposed to mention the struggles and the bad things, but Foggy knew Matt had never been ashamed of this. It was a part of his story, and he would have wanted it to be told. I know all the little things about Matthew Michael Murdoch, but I also know all the big things. Foggy switched to the next note card and noticed how much his hands were shaking when he couldn't ground them against the wooden surface of the lectern anymore. But he continued, trying to keep his voice steady, even as the words on the card were starting to swim in front of his eyes. Just like we didn't talk much about the past, we didn't talk much about the future, and when we did, we were rarely sober. He was talking fast now, faster than he knew he should, possibly even too fast for anyone to properly follow every word he was saying. Foggy didn't care. This wasn't about his family, the nuns, or the kids from the orphanage anymore. It wasn't about the few students that bothered to show up, or the father of Matt's church anymore. This was about Matt, and it was about Foggy. And one of them already knew the words, whilst the other one would never hear them. But I know that Matt had his heart set on being a lawyer, on helping people, long before I knew him. For Matt, it wasn't the money, even though he could have used it. He didn't care about that. For him, it was almost most important to help those who couldn't help themselves, to fight for the people who don't have the means or the power to fight on their own. That was what being a lawyer meant to Matt. And even if he never talked much about his religion either, I think that was what being a Catholic meant to Matt as well. Foggy looked up, his eyes getting stuck on the stained glass windows of the chapel for a moment. I'm not a Catholic. I'm not even particularly religious, so I don't feel like I'm the person to keep his legacy alive on that front. But I am a law student. I know how to fight the good fight using the laws of this country because Matt taught me. And I promise that I will honour Matt's legacy, his ideals, and his dreams of opening his own firm and offering legal services to those who can't afford them. Foggy had decided to end his speech with a promise, a vow. As long as I'm alive, a part of Matt Murdock will be. And I hope that if you take one thing away from this, you let it be Matt's dream of a better world for everyone. Foggy stacked the note cards, took a shaky breath, and looked around the room. He sniffled quietly, blinking back some of the tears he didn't want to spill, and then just gave a weak smile in Father Lantern's direction. He was supposed to say more, to invite other people to say a few words, or he wasn't sure what he was supposed to do anymore. Foggy hadn't planned to be doing this. He'd never imagined he would be reading a eulogy for his best friend at 24 years old. He wasn't supposed to be here. This wasn't supposed to happen. Matt Murdock was supposed to be alive. This wasn't supposed to be his life.
Chapter 2. Murdock never stays down. Jack muttered through the tears, dragging himself from the couch to tend to a screaming baby. A Murdock never gives up. He picked up Matt, hushing him. I know, baby, I know. You don't understand. I don't understand. He was hungry. Of course he was. He was barely a week old and he needed feeding, and he was Jack, left alone, and he didn't think he could just give him milk out the carton. And he couldn't leave him alone, and there was no one around to help him. Okay, baby. Right. This is going to be tough. Let's see about feeding you. They got through. Murdock's don't stay down. Despite the endless nights in which Matt simply screamed for his mother and Jack was never quite quick enough to make a bottle or to have that intuition of what he needed. He loved him, but that wasn't always enough to know how to help, what Matt needed. It was tough. It was a baby left in the corner in a pram while Jack fought in the ring to put money on the table. It was a room full of strangers passing Matt around, until the guys who Jack spent the most time with were seen as uncles, as something as close to family as the Murdochs were going to get. Matt grew older, and he survived. They both survived. They both kept their heads up, and they refused to stay down, despite what the world threw at them. When money ran tight, and Jack came home with bruises and cuts that he would teach Matt to sew and dress, a sip of whiskey to steady your hands. Evenings spent training, and Matt in the corner working on homework, a background noise of fists hitting punching bags and gloves hitting pads, the grunts and sighs of hard work on comradeship. The kid asked about his mother, as all kids would do, and all Jack could say was that she had left, that she had loved him because she surely did, and Jack still didn't understand where she'd stayed away, but they'd survived without her. Murdochs always get back up, and he was comforting a sobbing 9-year-old who'd done a brave thing and been punished for it, trying to persuade both Matt and himself that they were going to get through this, that it was awful and unchangeable, and it was cruel for the universe to give that to Matt, and yet it was still the hand they had been dealt. He'd learn. He was young. They adapted. Jack struggled. Matt struggled. They both spent time crying in frustration as Matt learned to walk again, to read again, to be able to write and navigate the world without a sight. The bill came from the hospital. Jack screamed whilst Matt was in school. They'd never afford this. He turned up to Fogwell's broken, begging for more fights, for more money, for anything to save them from losing their home. Fogwell did what he could, and Jack refused to accept help from the people he called brothers, and yet at some point, he did. For Matt, if not for him. That's how they persuaded him to take the money, that none of them wanted to see Matt struggle. The kid didn't deserve it. Jack made a promise to give it all back as soon as he could, that they'd be in better times soon, and that they'd be able to undo the pain, or as much as they could. Matt was still going to be blind, still forced to adapt to the rest of his life without a sight, and here, Jack was throwing fights to get bribes and come out with more than his winnings. It was nothing like he wanted to teach Matt. It wasn't fair, it wasn't right, it was less than legal, and he felt such dirty shame every time. For a while, it was all that kept a roof over their head, until they felt as though they were at least scraping by on their own steam. He wanted Matt to see him as a better man. Despite the bribes that were thrown at him, he was determined to fight fair and to win where he could. And then the posters went up for Murdoch vs. Creel, and hands were in pockets begging him to throw the fight in the fifth. The red robes arrived, and Matt was so excited, so young, so optimistic. This wasn't a fight Jack could throw with a guilt-free heart. The winnings would be better than the bribe. He could keep his fists up and his heart strong, and he could defeat Creel. He left Matt at home regardless. It wasn't safe for the kid. It would be a big fight, lots of spectators. Probably a lot of drama when he refused to throw it. Best that Matt is kept away from that. Better if he stays home.
Chapter 3.
Like his father, Matt had never been great at doing what he was told. He waited a while after his father had left for the fight, and then his cane was tap-tapping down the road towards Fogwell's gym. He knew the way by heart. After the accident, he had relearned to walk it, first with his father, then on his own, even before he'd learned the way to his school, the shop a few streets over, or the church they went to for Mass most Sundays. Matt knew the way, because it was his favourite place. The place where he'd grown up so far, and where he felt more at home than that real home. Matt's mobility coach didn't like that Matt was walking around Hell's Kitchen alone, and even if they wouldn't admit it, Matt knew his father and his uncles at Fogwell's agreed. But he didn't care. Hell's Kitchen was his home, and he'd never been afraid of its streets. Not before his accident, and not since. Even if it had been on its streets, where he'd been injured and blinded, and even if, since the accident, he could hear more of the crimes, and the pain, and the suffering that was going on outside every night. Maybe it was not that he trusted it despite all of that. Maybe it was because of it. Maybe Matt trusted his city because he knew it better than he knew himself sometimes. Matt walked through the familiar streets, trusting his feet, his cane, and his remaining senses to bring him to his second home, even as he knew darkness had fallen over the city. He could hear the commotion and the last preparations for the big fight, even from over a block away. The excited chatter and voices made Matt speed up his step, and as he got close enough to smell and taste the sweat and adrenaline in the air, his heartbeat sped up, and he almost felt like he was the one who would step into the ring to fight, instead of just being there to witness it. But Matt wouldn't fight. He never fought himself. Jack didn't want him to. He wanted his son to use his brain, his wit instead of his fists, to get where he wanted. But even if he never set foot into the ring on his own, not before, and definitely not since he got blinded, Matt wouldn't miss his dad's big fight for the world. He walked around the building, avoiding the windows where he knew he could be seen from inside, and folded his cane and stuck it into his coat pocket before carefully sneaking along the wall to the side entrance. Matt waited next to the door for a moment until he didn't hear footsteps in the hall anymore, then opened it and slipped inside. Just like Matt knew the way to Fogwell's by heart, he knew his way around the gym. He knew what door was the back door of the changing rooms, which door led to the men's bathrooms and which to the women's.
Matt knew which door was the stairs and which led to the equipment room and the broom closet. He slipped past all of them and through the main door that led to the actual gym, where the excitement was growing tangible as the narrator began greeting the spectators and the audience in front of the TV, where Matt was supposed to be. Matt used the moment of everyone cheering to open the door and slip into the hall, still keeping to the wall and just hoping no one would find him before he could hide in a corner. He didn't need to make it to the front of the crowd. It didn't make a difference for him anymore. He just needed to be there. "Hey, boy!" Fogger's voice cut through the noise and Matt froze. "You're not supposed to be here." Matt scrambled for something to say or somewhere to go, but between the crowd scrambling to senses and Fogwell quickly approaching him, Matt couldn't think of a solution quickly enough. "Your dad had good reason not to bring you here today, kid, and you know it." Fogwell sighed, grabbing Matt by the arm. His hold was gentle but strong, and Matt knew he didn't have much of a choice but to come with him when he started walking back out of the gym and into the hall. "Please don't send me home," Matt pleaded when the door had fallen closed behind them again. And old Fogwell stopped, leaning down to get on Matt's level. "Please, I just want to be here today." "Oh, Matty." Fogwell sighed again, but he nodded as well. "All right, you can stay. There's no way I convince you not to come back anyway." Matt smiled, already opening his mouth to thank him excitedly. Then the older man continued. "But," he warned, catching Matt's arm again before he could start towards the door. "You're staying in the office. Jack's right, this is no place for a little boy tonight, let alone a blind one. If you want to stay, you stay in the office upstairs." Matt hated being treated like he was nothing more than a frail, incompetent kid. "But..." He wanted to object, but he stopped when Fogwell's grip around his arm got stronger and gave in. "All right," he pressed out. "I'll stay in the office until the fight is over." "You stay in the office until I send someone to get you, or this is the last time I make an exception for you. Understood?" His voice was stern, and Matt knew it wasn't an empty threat, like the ones his dad usually made. "Yes, sir,"
Matt muttered, his face pointing at the ground between them magically. "This is for your own safety, Matty." Fogel sighed as he let go of the boy again. "We don't need you getting hurt anymore." Matt was fuming. Like so many times before, he wanted to yell that he could handle himself and that he wasn't going to break its challenge just because he couldn't see or because he was younger than everyone else around. He wanted to scream at his frustrations and pain, but Matt also knew that it wouldn't get him anywhere. At best, he'd be treated like a kid throwing a tantrum. At worst, they would blame it on the accident, trauma and whatnot, and treat him even more like he was a frail, scarred little thing they needed to fix. But he wasn't broken. So instead, Matt simply balled his hands into fists as he bit back his anger and nodded, trying, but definitely not quite managing, to keep his expression neutral. Fogwell took his arm again, all but dragging him up the stairs and towards the office. If there was one thing Matt hated even more than being treated like he would break if someone so much as breathed in his direction, it was being treated like he couldn't find the way to the bathroom on his own and had to be guided everywhere he wanted to go. "I can walk on my own," he growled, pulling his arm free and reaching for the handrail instead. He walked up the steps, only slowing down slightly when he felt the curve in the worn railing that indicated the top of the stairs, and determinedly did not take out his cane, even as he crossed the hallway on the upper floor. Instead, he walked up to the next wall, counting the closed doors and relying on his memory and senses not to walk into anything on the way to Fogwell's office. "You're too stubborn for your own good," Fogwell sighed, pulling out his office chair and waiting for Matt to sit down before he addressed him again. And remember, you're going to stay here until I send someone to get you, he warned again. This fight could take a while, so I hope you brought something to keep yourself entertained. Matt rolled his eyes, already listening more to the crowd and the announcer downstairs than to the man right in front of him again. Yes, I promise, he muttered annoyedly, when Fogwell was still there a moment later. I'll stay here until the fight is over and someone comes to get me. Good, Fogwell nodded, grabbing a ring-bound book from a shelf and handing it to Matt. You left this here the other day. Thanks. Matt tried to stay polite, even though he really just wanted the man to leave so he could focus all his attention on the fight that was about to start. Fogwell grumbled a wordless confirmation, then left the room, making sure to close the door behind him. Matt followed his steps down the stairs and through the hallway before they got lost in the crowd. It was only a moment later that the announcer's voice sounded over the loudspeaker system again, this time to start introducing the fighters. In the red corner, weighing in at 164 pounds from Hell's Kitchen, New York, please welcome Battling Jack Murdoch. Matt heard the announcer call, and in the hall between the locker room and the gym, he could hear his dad hyping himself up and slapping his gloves against each other as the crowd's cheers grew louder and louder.
Jack entered the ring. He faced his opponent, and even over the noise of the spectators and the announcer, Matt could hear his every step.
He could hear how the fight started, and how the two men circled each other for a moment before Jack made the first move. Matt had gloves hitting flesh and feet hitting the mat. He heard both men taking and landing hits, with both men getting more and more agitated as the fight went on. Matt heard Jack and Creel fight, round after round after round. The younger Creel was faster and more tireless, but Jack had the experience and he was relentless and unyielding. For every time Jack went down, he came back to his feet. For every hit he took, he threw one back at his opponent. The fight went on and on, 4, 5, 6, 7 rounds, and the crowd grew more and more excited. Somewhere in the middle, Matt caught snippets of a conversation. Someone was angry. He was cursing Jack and ordering men around, but Matt didn't pay attention to it. His sole focus was on the ring and on his dad. In the 10th round, Jack went down again, and he was starting to take longer to get back to his feet. Battling Jack spit out blood, a nasty sound accompanied by a smell that overpowered even the sweat of the two fighters and the crowd in the stuffy gym. But even though it took him longer, Jack got up. He got up and he made it to the end of the round. Matt could hear some of his uncles talking, and he could hear his dad's breath. It was fast and sounded ragged, definitely not healthy anymore. But Jack didn't give up. Murdochs get hit a lot, but they never stay down. A Murdoch never gives up. Jack didn't give up. The minute break was over quickly, and both men were back on their feet, breathing hard, ignoring the pain, the sweat and the exhaustion. They were filled with adrenaline and fueled by the cheers of the spectators and the excited calls of the announcer. Jack went down again, hitting the ground hard and not moving for a moment. Matt held his breath, counting the seconds as he heard his dad's breathing stop and Jack's heart skip a beat, but both Murdochs took in a deep gasping breath, and as Jack pulled himself back to his feet, Matt couldn't sit still any longer. He jumped to his feet, pacing the room in a tight circle, as his dad made it to the end of the round, still on his feet. The next minute, the last break felt endless. Matt's own breathing was going fast, and it took everything in him not to run out of the office, down the stairs, and into the gym. He needed to be there. He needed to see this. But he couldn't. Even if he was there, he wouldn't be able to see it. The only thing being down there would change was that Fogg would kick him out, this time for good, no matter how far into the fight they were already. The bell dinged again, indicating the end of the last rest period. Matt knew that there was only one way his dad could still win this fight. He'd been knocked down too many times to win by points. He had to win by knockout. And Matt knew his dad knew this as well. The last round started like the last few, with both fighters throwing hard, merciless punches. Murdoch lands another, and another! The announcer narrated the fight, and both Matt and the crowd cheered, rooting for their local hero. Creel is rocked! Murdoch won't let him out the corner. The younger Creel seemed stunned by the ferocious display by the more seasoned Murdoch. Jack had the upper hand. He had control over the ring, and everything was going right. But Matt had underestimated Creel, and in his hazy state of what was probably at least a moderately severe concussion, so did Jack. Creel landed a calculated hit, breaking out of the corner, then another to push Battling Jack into the opposite corner, and a third to knock him off his feet. Jack hit the mat, but the smack of flesh on plastic-covered rubber wasn't what took Matt's breath away. It wasn't the sound of ribs creaking with the impact, or the smell of blood spilling from yet another cut on Jack's face either. It was the irregular stutter of Jack's heartbeat, the air being pushed out of his lungs, and finally the echoing silence when his father was supposed to get up. Matt didn't listen to the referee counting down the seconds, or the commentator announcing Creel's victory. He didn't listen to the crowd cheering, or Battling Jack's fans lamenting that he had lost. Matt knew something was wrong. The only thing the boy listened to was the lack of a heartbeat and the lack of a gasping breath as Jack woke up again. The only thing Matt listened to was Fogwell and the other boxers who frequented the gym, crowding around the ring even as Creel was celebrated. He listened to hushed curses, to worried conversations, and to Jack being dragged out of the ring to the side. He listened to someone starting CPR and to someone calling an ambulance. Matt was frozen in place as he listened to his father's ribs creaking with every push of strong arms and every breath that was manually pushed into Jack's lungs via mouth to mouth. He didn't move as he heard the crowd notice that something was off, or when the room fell quiet for a second before erupting into worried comments. Matt barely breathed as some of the people he considered family started clearing the hall, or as the ambulance arrived and paramedics and police took over the scene. Matt stumbled back against the desk as he heard the electronic whine and the unnatural contracting of muscles as the defibrillator shocked Jack's heart. Again and again. Futilely, uselessly, the boy grabbed for the edge of the desk as the paramedics talked to each other and to the remaining people in the room. He listened as they talked about what had happened, about the fight and the injuries Jack had sustained. Matt couldn't breathe as they shocked Jack again, felt his pulse again, and finally decided it was useless. He lost control over his body as they declared Jack's death. The next few moments were more a flash of sensation than real memories. The sound of winter boots on old wooden stairs as Matt ran out of the office and down to the ground floor. The familiar smell of sweat, leather and plastic as he followed his instincts and ran into the changing rooms to hide like he had every time he got scared during a fight since he was a little kid. The feeling of cold metal on his fingertips as he opened the third locker on the left side, with muscle memory leading him here more than any real decision. Matt remembered the world getting echoey and quieter, finally quieter. The smells of the gym were overpowered by the smells of home. Leather, Dad's aftershave, and his favourite brand of cigarettes. A combination of many scents and impressions swirled through Matt's mind, mixed with the new sounds that got burned into his mind and overwhelmed him. Matt cried. He couldn't control it. He couldn't stop. He could barely breathe. Then, for a while, there was nothing. Black, soundless, and dreamless sleep. Voices. Not enough to really wake him, but enough to have left a lasting memory. They were hushed and whispered too quietly to be heard, but their sound was familiar. For another moment, everything was quiet again. The gym had quietened down, the crowd had been sent away, and police and paramedics had cleared the scene. Jack had been brought away. They'd looked for Matt, and Fogwood told his men that he was in the office. He hadn't been. They looked everywhere. Someone was sent to their home, and the others were searching every corner of the gym. They found him curled around his father's street clothes, crying in his sleep at the bottom of Jack's locker. People brought mats, pillows, anything that resembled a blanket. Someone wrapped Jack's robe around his son. Someone else took the glasses off his face. Everyone stayed in the locker room that night. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know what would happen to Matt. The only thing they could do was give him this one night. No one knew how Matt even knew what had happened. He hadn't been in the gym. Fogel was sure of it. There was no way he could have heard what was going on in the office. Matt didn't remember much of the next day. He woke up where he'd fallen asleep, the metal walls and the endless darkness around him a cruel reminder that the last years hadn't been a nightmare, but cold, hard reality. Matt remembered familiar heartbeats, the people of Fogwell's, men he considered uncles. Matt remembered the gentle touches of calloused hands as they held him as they cried again, overwhelmed and not understanding why the world seemed to take everything from him. Matt remembered their small apartment, suddenly feeling too big, too empty, and just wrong. Matt remembers strange voices and smells, foreign people telling him that everything would be okay and that they would take care of him now. Matt remembered the heartbreak as he had to say goodbye to his second family. Their voices were steady as they promised to come visit and that they would always be there when Matt needed them, but the boy could smell the saltiness of tears on every single one of them as they hugged him tight. Matt remembered the scent of dirt, the sound of voices saying things that were true, but not the truth about his father, and the feeling of strong hands on his shoulders as people gave him words of encouragement that meant nothing. When Matt was asked, he said the funeral was nice, and that the people of Fogwell's at Clinton Church had put effort in to make it a dignified occasion with the means they had. The truth was, like many days of his childhood, Matt didn't remember the day his father was buried.
Chapter 4. The orphanage was noisy, the sounds unfamiliar, every sob from another lost child reminding him of his own grief. He didn't sleep. He couldn't sleep. He lay there for hours and hours, listening, waiting for something that was never going to happen. The city outside of the walls was too loud, and there was so much death and danger and sadness in the world. He sobbed, and nobody could fix him. He screamed, and soon even those that were supposed to care seemed to stop. His grief was unfixable, and it was better to spend time on the people the nuns could fix. It was in the dark and cool of the night he'd find himself sneaking out to sit beside his father's grave, the soil damp under the dew. There was little point in trying to sleep. He knew by now it was futile. For in sleep came nightmares, and that awful, soul-shattering memory of his father's heart stopping for the last time, in a fight he was supposed to lose, but not like this. To have lost on his own terms would have meant he would be here still, surely. That was something that could have been changed, that pride defeats all that try to control it. Days passed into over a week, and poor blind orphan Matthew Murdoch continued to refuse to sleep. His body fought against him, the world not making sense, and he lashed out at those who thought to help him. At some point he broke and shattered and collapsed, and was found on the ground sobbing, unable to move. His hands tried to claw into the ground in some sense of opportunity to ground himself, until his nails were cracked and bleeding, and red rivulets ran down his palms. They wrapped him in blankets to transport him to the hospital, and the sobs were the sound to shatter hearts. At some point, he slipped into unconsciousness, and it was some sort of peace, until the nightmare started and he woke up screaming again. There were strangers around him, and he couldn't see, and he wanted his dad, and he couldn't see, and he heard his dad's heart stop in a fight he was supposed to lose, but not like this. He pressed his hands over his ears, and something tugged at the back of one of them, but he needed to muffle the noise of everything that surrounded him, within the hospital, within the surrounding blocks, within the rest of the city. Something cold leached into his blood, the world muffled quickly, and it became easier to deal with. He could no longer hear the rest of the hospital, was no longer assaulted by the overwhelming smell of antiseptic and blood. He could lower his hands from his ears, and his thought felt like molasses, but it was better. Better to think slowly before his brain had a chance to catch up. There, is that better? It's a lot, I know. Lots of people in here, right, kiddo? The stranger gestured, some sort of movement to the people around them, and a number settled out of the room. You've not been sleeping at all, right? Can you tell me why? It's too loud! Everything! It's too much! His dad had helped to ground him without even knowing it. The steady sounds of his sleeping heartbeat in the next room when the city was too quiet to drown out the sounds of hurt. And he wasn't here anymore. He had abandoned him. He had left him, and he was all alone, and he didn't know anyone, and perhaps if things had been different, he would have still been here. He couldn't read the notes the doctors had written about him, but he heard the murmurs of the sisters when they came to visit. Sensory overload, blind, refer back to O&M, query autism, grief, refer to counseling, refer to therapy, refer, refer, refer. The sisters all said the same in response. They couldn't afford that. Neither the money nor the time to jump through hoops and persuade the stage, and it wasn't as though he was physically hurting. To them, at least. Some of the meaner sisters simply told him to pull himself together, that he was too grown to be acting like this. They seemed to have a system. It'd help him keep track of the days throughout the haze of sedation. It seemed to most as though it was a chore coming to see him. They never stayed long, and sighed at the doctors when they told they'd have to take him home soon. Sister Maggie, who seemed to have a love-hate relationship with Matt, only came once, and then never again. The others shook their head when he asked why. Eventually, the time came that he was taken back. At home, nowhere was home anymore, but to the orphanage where the halls were filled with children as lost as he was. Something in him had changed enough that he could at least cry himself to sleep now, until exhaustion took over. The first few nights they checked on him when they heard him crying, but eventually even that stopped, and he wept silently with the knowledge nobody was coming to save him.
Chapter 5.
Since waking up in the hospital for the first time, the day of the accident, every day Matt had noticed his remaining senses were starting to get stronger. By now he could hear every sound in a block's radius, taste single ingredients in foods, smell the faintest hints of a scent, and feel the movement of air around him. At first, it had been helpful, allowing him to navigate the world around him with those additional inputs where his sight was missing. Then it was what had made him hear his father's heartbeat, the last breath he took and the exact second he died. And finally, he could sense anything and everything around him. It was overwhelming and more painful than the damage the chemicals had done to his eyes and face ever could have been. It was painful and overwhelming, and it was the reason he ended up in hospital the second time, weeks after Jack's death, when he hadn't slept a single night since then. It was overwhelming and painful, and every night as he cried himself into exhaustion, Matt grieved not only his dad, but the sedation that had, for once, muffled the world and the pain around him. But even as Matt had to relearn how to live in a world that changed every day, as his senses grew more refined and more sensitive, he also learned that there were perks to it, even if they were hard to find between everything that made his life so much worse. One day, as Matt was sitting on the edge of his bed, balling his fist till his two long nails were digging into his skin and trying to somehow focus his mind enough to get up, get dressed and leave his room, there was a knock on the door. Matt flinched at the noise, and his head automatically turned to the door. He could sense two nuns, the familiar smell of plain soap, cheap detergent and porridge, one of the few constants in the ever-changing environment of the orphanage. But there was someone else. A foreign heartbeat, too slow to be a kid, too strong to be a nun, too harsh to be Father Lambton, and too unfamiliar to be any of the men from Fogwell's. And a foreign smell, sweat like at the gym, blood like after a long fight, tea like an early morning at home. Home, fights, Fogwell's. Before Matt could react to the door opening, or even just to the knock itself, he was already spiralling. He was spiralling, losing every ounce of control he had over the ever-growing noise around him. Matt was spiralling, and the flimsy protection he had built around himself crashed down on him, letting in every sound, every scent, and every taste. Matt could hear the voices of dozens of kids, the yells and cries they were playing. He could hear every heartbeat, every breath, and every sound, except for the one thing he wanted and needed to hear. Matt could smell the scents that were so familiar to him but so wrong at the same time. He could taste the sweat and his own tears, and years and years and years of history in the air around him. The boy could feel the sheets under him, rough on his skin, hurting with every touch. He could feel his pyjamas restricting him, making it feel like breathing was impossible, and he could feel all the scars and scratches on his arms and legs, on his back,
and on his stomach where he had held onto the one constant thing, the one thing that he had left, where he had held onto himself and broke the skin with his own nails. Matt spiraled and he screamed, not even realising it until the nuns pinned him to his bed and his throat was starting to hurt, rough from too much crying and too little speaking. The nuns were rough with Matt. They hadn't always been, and still not all of them were, but the few that came to him every day to make sure he ate something and drank enough water so he wouldn't end up in the hospital, overtired and underfed, they'd given up on gentleness. And, just like Matt was used to by then, the nuns that brought the stranger to his room stopped his flailing and scratching at his own skin, and held him down until the learned reaction kicked in and he stopped screaming. Matt didn't want to stop, but he knew that they wouldn't let go of him until he did. Matt knew the pain of their touch, and the restriction of his movements wouldn't stop until he did. Matt, can you pull yourself together and stop acting like a toddler having a temper tantrum for at least a few minutes? One of the nurses asked, her tone sarcastic and fed up. Matt wasn't sure which nun was speaking to him. He was trying to learn how to tell them apart, but everything was mixing together in his mind. And it wasn't like he wanted to act like this either. Matt wanted to be normal. He wanted to go out and play like the other kids. He wanted to go to school and learn, and he wanted to be good, like his dad had taught him. It was just all too much. He just nodded. Matt hated the way the movement sounded in his mind. He hated the feeling of his too long hair brushing his skin, the pillows and sheets and rustling in his ear. And he hated how much more the world was spinning around him as he set the air around his head in motion. He did his best to hide his reaction. We would like you to meet someone, the second nurse on the other side of Matt added. Her voice was softer, gentler. Matt didn't like being crowded like this. He just nodded again, trying to place the strange man in the room. This is Stick. The first nun had taken a few steps back to the middle of the room, Matt realised, when her voice came from a different direction. He's blind, like you, and he's here to teach you how to navigate the world of your disability. Matt hated when people treated him like that fragile little blind boy everyone seemed to see in him. He was blind, sure, but he'd been blind before his dad had died too, and then he was perfectly able to navigate the world on his own too. It wasn't being blind that was the problem. It was the world being too much, too loud, all the time. It was the fact that his dad was gone, and he wasn't allowed to see the only family he had left. Matt nodded again, then realised they probably wanted him to say something. I'm Matt, he said, feeling for the edge of the bed before getting up. And I don't need your help. He had learned how to navigate the world already. He'd had a mobility coach and lessons in how to read and write Braille. Jack had made sure of it as soon as Matt's diagnosis was set. Matt knew what it meant that he was blind. He didn't understand everything else that was going on in his mind, his body, and all around him. Like with so many other things, Matt wasn't given that choice. Stick will help you learn all the things you need to know, the first nun said again. Now anger was starting to creep into her voice. And you will listen to what he has to teach you. I don't care how long it takes until you finally understand that you can't act like this anymore. Matt bit his teeth together and balled his hands into fists, keeping his anger and frustration on the inside, like his dad had taught him. Jack had never liked it when Matt got physical with his anger. Matt took a deep breath, ignoring the wave of scents and taste that came with it, and nodded again. Fine, he said. Can I change into street clothes first? Every fibre of his being was screaming by the time Matt was dressed and ready, including his sunglasses and white cane. The clothes the nun had given him were cheap, worn, and didn't fit right. Most of the things the dad had been able to buy would have fit that description, but especially in the last year, Jack had always taken care that Matt was comfortable in his clothes. The nuns didn't care. They didn't ask what type of clothes Matt liked to wear or if the things he had to wear made his skin feel like it was on fire and his throat close up so he couldn't breathe. They didn't care. They'd given up caring for Matt when they'd realised that the other kids would take their attention and bloom, while Matt was still the same days, weeks and months after he'd moved into St. Agnes. They think you're getting worse, Stick said, when they were alone after the nuns had left. But you're not.
Are you, kid? For a moment, nothing happened, except for the soft rustle of clothes, then a metallic clink. Before Matt finally understood what was happening, the metallic object was tearing through the air. His hand moved up, neatly wrapping around what turned out to be a set of keys, and catching it before it could collide with his face. You're getting stronger. The man's voice was self-satisfied for a moment before he sighed deeply, going back to the same sort of indifference he had had just a moment before. Let's get started. Stick brought Matt to the park, explaining to him on the way that he was training Matt not just in a way he could use his sense of the world to navigate his daily life, but, more importantly, in ways he could use them to his advantage, on a larger scale. So, what kind of training is this? Matt asked, not for the first time, when they were sitting on a bench in the middle of the park. Stick had brought him ice cream, plain, vanilla-flavoured ice cream, and picked a bench where most other people would have been able to oversee most of the park if they wanted to. Do you like ice cream? Stick asked, already annoyed by Matt's questions, after less than an hour they'd spent together. Yeah, Matt answered irritatedly. He might have been different than any other kid he knew, but who didn't like ice cream? Then shut up and eat it, Stick growled. I'll ask the questions. Matt wanted to reciprocate but missed his moment. Stick was relentless on that front. First thing you got to understand is nobody feels sorry for you and nobody ever will. Stick continued, and Matt decided to just eat his ice cream and listen to what he had to say. Because when it comes to being born lucky, you won the friggin' lottery. I did? Matt scoffed. There was nothing about his life that felt like he had won anything. The material of Stick's cane whistled in the air as he used it like a knife, held against Matt's throat to shut him up. What did I say about questions? Matt wasn't intimidated by the man. His father had never wanted him to learn much about fighting, but that didn't mean Jack Murdoch hadn't taught his son anything. And anyway, what was Stick going to do in the middle of a busy park? Shut up, Matt guessed, giving the old man his best attempt at death glare, but not even sure if he aimed it in the right direction. Good. Stick sounded as if nothing had happened again, taking his cane back and relaxing back into his seat. How old were you when you got blinded? Matt didn't like this question. What did it matter how old he had been? There was no way the nuns hadn't told Stick every little detail about him either. He had to know how old Matt had been. 9. 9? Stick asked, mocking him. So you had 9 whole years of looking at movies, blue skies, up girlie skirts that I never had. He continued. I was born blind. You don't hear me whining about it, do you? No. Matt shook his head instinctively. He didn't know what Stick was aiming at. Before he had learned about the man in the short time he had known him, he could already guess that he wasn't going to like it. And that Stick wasn't going to like it if he interrupted him. So, you're 9 years old, walking along, minding your own business, and whammo, get hit by a truck, killed dead on the spot. I wasn't killed, Matt scoffed. You lived? Stick kept mocking him. Matt hated it. Praise God, it's a miracle. He didn't leave room for Matt to say anything. So you survive the truck and get this chemical shit in your eyes. What next? I hear things. Matt knew he didn't have much of a choice but to answer. And even despite the mocking and teasing and the rough exterior, something told Matt that Stick understood more about what was going on with him than the nuns ever could. And even more than his dad would have ever been able to. What kind of things? Everything, Matt said simply. Coughs and fights and cats meowing. He hesitated for just a second, then decided to tell Stick the truth. Maybe he wasn't entirely trustworthy, but Matt also knew that he was probably his only chance. Sometimes blocks away. And the thing with the keys was proof that Stick already knew more than he let on. I can sense things. I know where things are and when and how they move. He sighed, feeling the need to clarify. But I can't see. You know what they call stuff like that? Stick asked, leaning closer ever so slightly. Gifts, the special kind, The kind that very few people have or deserve. To Matt, his senses, the way he experienced the world, didn't feel like a gift. It felt more like a punishment, and he didn't know what he had done to deserve this punishment. I never thought about it that way. Well, that's because you're stupid, Stick said. Matt couldn't let this one stand. I'm not stupid, I'm smart. Because you taught yourself how to run your little fingers over the bumps and read Braille? Stick shook his head, the movement clearly audible when Matt focused on him. Smart don't come out of books, kid. Smart is making the right decision at the right time. He paused for a second. Like, now. What's it going to be, Matty? You going to spend your life crying and rocking yourself to sleep at night? Of course, Matt didn't want that. It was just... he didn't see another way. Or are you going to dig deep and find out what it takes to reshuffle those cards life dealt you? You're cool. Matt didn't say or do much for a moment, but apparently Stick could tell that he was considering it, and apparently that was enough. Good choice, kid, he chuckled. No one's bought me ice cream since my dad died, Matt said instead of answering the question or reacting to Stick interpreting his silence as an answer. He was turning the wrapper in his hands, his fingers remembering something his dad had taught him, almost automatically. What's it taste like? Vanilla, Matt pointed out. It was an obvious answer to a stupid question. Stick had bought vanilla, without even asking Matt what he liked or wanted. But Stick just scoffed. Everybody can taste vanilla. Pay a little more attention, use those gifts. You know what you got? He held the ice cream up to his nose and smelled it. Matt simply took another bite, ignoring the arguably weird gesture. Sugar grains, vanilla bean, milk from 3 different dairies across 2 states. Now Matt was starting to get curious. Could Stick really tell all of that from just smelling the ice cream? The old man licked the ice cream, then pulled a face. Ugh, batch of chemicals straight off the periodic tables, and... he sniffed it again. Dirt off the guy's hand that served it to you. He spent his morning gardening. Matt could actually tell most of these things when he focused hard enough. It made his head swirl and the constant headache he had worse. But it was fascinating, in a way, to learn out the positives of his powers, or at least the extent. Whole world around you, Matty, and it is frigging huge. And all you need are the guts to let it in. Try. A man with a dog was walking past. Matt could hear the paws on the pavement, different from the sound human feet and shoes made, and the clicking of the hardware on his leash. The dog, what's his story? Stick asked, and Matt focused. He could hear a lot more when he took the time and energy to focus on a single thing, and do his best to blur everything else into the background. He's hungry. His stomach's growling, and he's dying to eat the hot dogs that guy's carrying just upwind of him. The dog stopped for a moment, but the man walking with it didn't pay much attention to it. Not bad, Stick acknowledged. A couple walked past them, man and woman, chatting happily and holding hands. What about the girl? Matt focused on her instead, doing his best to stay on target and gather everything he could find out. Her skin's too hot. The two adults stopped a few feet away from them, facing each other and now holding the other in both hands. Her heart's beating fast. Matt turned a little in Stick's direction, worried. Is she sick? Worse, Stick said, unbothered. She's in love. Continued without pause. And the old man? The man Stick was talking about was sitting across the path from them, feeding old bread to a small flock of pigeons. Something was off about him, but it took a moment until Matt realised what it meant. Even once he had realised it, it was hard to say. He's dying. And there's nothing you can do about it. Stick didn't care how much it hurt Matt. Big world, not all of it flowers and sunshine. And the only way guys like you and me can survive is to grab it by the throat and never let go. Matt tucked the ice cream wrapper in his pocket, swallowing hard at Stick's words, but also the memories of being here and eating ice cream had brought back. If I ask you a question, will you hit me? He asked. It was meant to be sarcastic, but it came out more honest than Matt liked.
"Depends on the question," Stick answered, but Matt felt like he wanted him to go on this time.
"How did you find me?" he asked. "How did you know?"
"Old Biddy at the orphanage thinks it's her idea." Stick's answer was inconclusive and meaningless.
Matt was starting to accept that he ever wanted to know something from Stick, this might be the best he would get. But it wasn't, was it?
"Maybe it's one of my gifts," Stick continued, just as vague. "Or you just got lucky."
Matt scoffed again, starting to get frustrated. He hated when people didn't tell him stuff they thought he was too young, too stupid, or too broken to understand. And even if this wasn't the same with Stick, it felt similar.
"That's not an answer."
Stick chuckled.
"You catch on quick."
"You going to help me?" Matt asked then.
"No, I'm going to train you. How to control your gift, make it work for you. Use it, and how to fight."
"My dad never wanted me to fight," Matt pointed out. He had never particularly liked that decision, but he understood where it was coming from.
"Your dad ain't here."
Stick was cold, as he had been the entire time. "You'll need skills for the war."
"What war?"
Matt wasn't sure if this was meant to be a euphemism or a metaphor he didn't understand, or if Stick thought he was going to fight in a real war.
"We'll get to that part when you're ready," Stick answered.
Matt was starting to feel the fury boiling him again. He balled his fists again, closing his eyes behind his dark glasses and taking a deep breath, like he had earlier at the orphanage. The scents of the park were even more overpowering than the ones in his room, but a simple motion alone made Matt feel better too.
"If you're not going to answer my questions, will you at least tell me what we're doing here?"
Matt asked, facing Stick again and trying to growl as much as his voice let him. It didn't end up sounding nearly as menacing as when Stick did it, or when his father had done it.
"We're having ice cream at the park, kid,"
Stick said, unhelpful and unnecessary. "Keep up." Matt balled his fists again, biting back a comment and focusing back on his ice cream, instead of demanding an actual answer that he knew he wasn't going to get. He finished the sweet vanilla treat and waffle cone, then picked up his cane, more to have something to do with his hands and distract himself from the noise of the city than because he needed it right then. Stick's behaviour towards Matt didn't change over the weeks and months they spent together. He was harsh and rough, not giving an answer that went further than pointing out Matt's weaknesses and failings to any of Matt's questions, and insisting that what he was teaching the boy was more important than anything he could learn at school or with an actual teacher. Matt wasn't sure it was true. He didn't think he needed most of the things Stick taught him. He didn't think he needed to know how to drop a man unconscious with a single hit, how to fight his way out of a chokehold, or how to fight three people at the same time without losing track of their steps and hits. Matt didn't think he needed to know how to fight. Not the way Stick taught him, and not the way his father had refused to teach him. But Matt couldn't deny that with each lesson the old man forced onto him, he got more of a grip on his senses. Between learning fighting techniques, hits and kicks and grips and throws, Matt learned how to focus on his own body and the things around him that mattered. As he learned manoeuvres of many fighting styles from all over the world that quickly and almost naturally mixed into Matt's own way of moving and reacting to the threat Stick was throwing at him, he learned to tell apart the breaths and heartbeats of the people around him. Matt learned to tell apart the scent of a scared person and one who was angry when Stick confronted him with countless opponents, all of whom were stronger, bigger and more experienced than him. He learned to predict movements by the changes in air currents and the position of the sensory inputs around him when Stick taught him to dodge and counter any and all types of ranged attacks. Matt learned how to navigate the world without using his cane, following walls or being guided, when Stick took his cane, leaving him standing alone in the middle of the gym they were using to train for hours at a time. Matt learned from Stick what none of the nuns, his teachers at school, or any of the other coaches his father, the school, or the orphanage had sent could teach him. It was hard work. Matt still cried himself to sleep more nights than not.
but he was starting to get a grip on his life and the world at the same time. And despite how much Matt hated the man and everything he seemed to stand for at first, he was starting to get attached. Stick started to mean something to him. He started to be one of the people who changed Matt's life the most, and for all the pain and distress he caused him, he gave Matt opportunities and chances he didn't think he could have when he first ended up at the orphanage. Stick started to mean something to him, and just that was what drove him away in the end. Stick had taken Matt to the park again. It was almost a habit by then, a thing they did regularly. At the time, Matt thought it was because he enjoyed it. A nice break in between the lessons and training for that war Stick was still refusing to tell him anything tangible about. Years later, Matt had learned that a lot of things Stick had done with him, to him, as his closest friend would insist, had a lot darker intentions than he realised. But at the time, Matt enjoyed these trips to the park to get ice cream, to sit on a park bench and to learn about the world around them, step by step. Each time, Stick asked Matt to focus on something different, something new. Each time, Matt did his best to hone his senses on the fine and almost impossible to pick out details Stick wanted to hear about. Each time, Matt's hands were moving of their own accord, fidgeting with his cane and the paper wrapping of the ice cream cone. Each time, Matt ended up with a small figure or trinket that his hands had folded without him thinking much about it. It was a habit he'd picked up when he was here with his father. Jack had taught him many of these neat little tricks, small ways to keep him entertained and happy that would stick with him for the rest of his life. One time, Matt made a stupid decision. One time, Matt did what he did best. One time, Matt lost the one person who'd helped him in the chaos and darkness that was his life. One time, just before Stick was going to teach him a new technique, Matt still didn't know what he needed to learn how to fight with knives for, but he'd learned to simply accept that Stick had his reasons. Matt approached the man. He had, once again, made a trinket, a bracelet folded from the delicate paper, and for the first time, he scraped together his courage and gave the little token to his mentor. It was the last time Matt had heard anything of the man. Like too many times before, Matt was back down to zero. Zero people who truly supported him. Zero people who wanted to help. Zero people he could trust. Like too many times before, Matt was crying himself to sleep at night. Only this time, Matt remembered something his father had taught him since he was young. A Murdoch never stays down.
Chapter 6. In another life, maybe Jack would have taken the money, and maybe Matt would have had a better chance for the future. But as it was, he spent his years in education fighting for survival, for the hope of enough to do what it was he wanted. To help people, in the way his father had wished, not with his fists, but with his words. To become a lawyer, a dream he was still set on even after everything. It was hard, there was no denying it, and pity went a far way in helping him along, as well as the fight of the devil. He failed. A few times he failed when his mind wouldn't work in the way he wanted it to, when grief and anger destroyed his ability to learn, and the endless sleepless nights ruined any chance at friendships. Warning after warning, followed by expulsions and begging at the doorsteps of other schools that he was deserving of education. Some would look at it, see his list of expulsions, and turn him away without a second chance, until it felt as though he'd been traveling across the entirety of America to search for someone who would respect him, who would allow him to learn. At this point, he didn't know what he would do if they said no. If everyone said no to him, would he end up in the same life as his father? With no education, forced to fight to put food on the table, to keep a roof over his head, blind, poorly educated, without a friend or family to call his own. Stick's teachings had at least helped, but he wasn't supposed to be a warrior. He wanted to live. Somehow he made it. Somehow he clawed his way through the years, emerging victorious with enough achievement to go and learn law at Columbia. It had felt like begging, getting enough of a scholarship to even be able to afford it, enough evidence that he was good enough, he was smart enough. Perhaps he was a few years older than his peers. Perhaps it had been more than a fight than any of them would ever realize. But he had made it. He was capable. It was a promise to everyone that had ever doubted him, and even more so to those who had believed in him. That he would do good by them, and good by the world, and that at the end of it, he'd be able to honor his father's wishes after all, using his head, not his fists, to fight what was unjust and help those that did not deserve the hands the world had dealt them. In another world again, maybe there would have been someone who could have helped the Murdochs, all those years ago. Money had always been an issue, with the hospital bills after the accident, and if they had ever been able to afford it, maybe someone could have helped. Or maybe if there had been more people, or any people, offering pro bono work, Jack could have had the help he needed, that they deserved. It was something that stuck with Matt, a promise he made to himself for the future, that he would help even those who were not able to pay for themselves, that he would make an effort to help those most in need, because his world would have been a lot different if someone had been there to help him. He could still remember the people he called his uncles, crying as he was taken to live in the orphanage, that if one of them, or all of them, could afford to fight for him, he may have ended up somewhere else. They were the closest thing he had to family. As he grew older, he drifted from them. The sisters were never overly keen to let them visit, or to let Matt go on his own to see them. A place with people like that is no space for a child. At this point, he didn't even know if they'd want to see him anymore. And like his father, he didn't want to feel like he was relying on the help of others. He was going to get through this on his own. The letter in his hand to Columbia was proof of that, as he boarded the bus with a few worldly possessions and headed there at the start of the school year.
Chapter 7. Overall, living in the dorms wasn't hugely different from living at St. Agnes. It wasn't exactly the same, of course, but it was similar enough that Matt got used to it fairly quickly. The biggest difference was probably sharing a room with Foggy. Matt had shared his room with other people before. It was a dubious privilege that he had his own room for as long as he did. But it was different with Foggy. Foggy was, for the lack of a better description, happy. Matt didn't know what to do with that. It was nice, most days. Foggy's good mood was contagious, and oftentimes it helped Matt forget the dark parts of his life, at least for a few hours. But the rest of the time, when Matt couldn't forget about the pain and the loss, about the overstimulation and everything that happened since that day when a split-second decision had changed his life, Foggy made everything worse. It wasn't that Foggy meant to overwhelm Matt. It wasn't that he meant to push his cheerful personality onto Matt, who Foggy seemed to have quickly deemed his new best friend, which was just another thing Matt didn't know how to handle. Or to make him grieve the happy and safe childhood Matt never got to have with his stories of his family, his siblings and parents, and more extended family than Matt could count. Over time, over the first few days, weeks and the months of their first semester together, Matt got used to Foggy. He got used to having someone who cared about him. Getting used to it didn't mean trusting it. Matt knew too well how easily and how quickly everything good could crumble into nothing. Matt knew not to trust the good things in his life. His childhood, his dad, Stick, it all broken down, shattered and crumbled to dust. It was only a matter of time until this would too. It turned out it was only a matter of time until losing Foggy was the worst thing Matt could think of. A few weeks into the semester, Matt had gotten used to his roommate's loud and easily excited nature. He was used to Foggy's fidgeting when he was excited, to the small sounds and hums he made when he was focusing on homework, or cooking, or really anything he was doing. And he was used to coming home to someone who gave a happy little smile and a "Hi, how are you?" that was actual genuine interest, rather than a polite pretense he was expected to offer. About 3 months in, Matt started to get used to Foggy bringing him a hot chocolate, or a sweet treat, or making his favourite foods when he noticed Matt was down, overwhelmed from a long day and too many sensory inputs. Matt started to get used to Foggy caring about him, in a way that he hadn't known since Jack had died and since he had last seen his friends, his family, at Old Fogwell's gym. It brought up conflicting emotions and memories in Matt.
As much as he enjoyed Foggy's company and caring nature, Matt had days where all he could think of was the life he had missed out on. As much as Foggy's gentle nudges to eat and drink water and to get some fresh air when he was feeling like the walls were closing in on him were appreciated, it reminded Matt of that first time at the orphanage in some strange, almost cruel way he couldn't quite fathom. And as much as Matt appreciated Foggy trying to help, the other boy didn't understand, could never understand what he was dealing with. So, Foggy said one day, as Matt and he were lying on the floor next to each other, just after Foggy'd come home to find his roommate there. If it's your dad's old gym that always felt like home, and that you've missed most over the years. He was frowning, trying to understand what Matt didn't know how to put into words. Then why don't you just go there? I know it's still open. I've got a cousin who drains there, like twice a week. And it's not like anyone's going to stop you anymore. You're an adult now. You can do whatever you think is right. It wasn't as easy as that. There was so much choked up inside that place, inside Matt, that he didn't think it was an easy fix. But the way that Foggy had said it so gentle and so easily, with no pressure, it was a reminder in a way that he was an adult. He did have a choice in the path his life was taking. He did have the choice to go back now. And no one, not the nuns at St. Agnes, not some social worker, not Stick, could stop him anymore. His return had been long overdue. Even if it still felt like just a moment ago he was lying on the floor of that changing room, surrounded by the men that used to be his family.
Chapter 8. Fogwells was familiar and yet also different and heartbreaking at the same time. It was all the memories of what once was and what should have been, the scent of rusted lockers, of the plastic and leather of punching bags and gloves, sweat of too many people exercising in the same place, fighting together, fighting against each other, violence and anger and passion, pain, grief, sadness. These walls still held the memories of that awful, tragic, broken night. He could still hear the chants of the fight, could still feel as his heart and fists echoed the same final fight, the same movements entrenched into every last part of his memory. Murdoch's never give up. Step, step, step. Punch, punch, punch. Don't stay down. Get back up. His uncles were familiar voices, familiar bodies, and he was so much bigger now and more capable of holding a fight. They spoke to him, said, "Your dad never wanted you to fight. I need to. It itches to get out." He couldn't tell the expressions they shared amongst each other as they stepped into the ring with him, and for a second they were taken by surprise by what he could do. But it was always a fight. Go, go, go. Step, step, step. And Murdoch always gets back up. Get back up. Please. It wasn't enough. The voices in his mind still screamed, and with it the sound of those on the street echoed back. People in grief, people in danger, those who did not or could not fight, those who were hurt and held by those with more powers. Innocents, children, unspeakable crimes. He listened. Because what else could he do besides give them the space and time to be heard, those voices who screamed into the night with pain and suffering? And then he followed. He hunted, he prowled, he heard the crime and he heard the truth that nobody was going to save them. That was up to him alone to track them down, to find those who hurt others and stop them. It was easy, too easy, the first blow. How different and how familiar the feel of skin under his fist was to punching back in the gym. It filled him with a sense of pride, of joy and satisfaction, that the devil inside his soul was rewarded, and at the same time, someone was being punished. For there were too many people in this world who did terrible things. Things that he had no choice but to listen to, that he could have a choice in how he reacted to them. And it helped. It released the devil within him. An outlet for the anger, either against the punching bag or against skin. There was more of a mental satisfaction, knowing that the bruises he left on a stranger's skin came with a message and a warning. But there was someone out there protecting those who needed it. Each blow was the hopeful end to a tragic story of pain. Each scream of fear, pure adrenaline in Matt's heart. It was addicting. It was powerful. He was powerful. He was in the same small, scared child who had been abandoned. He wasn't a poor, blind orphan. He was power on the streets, a nameless, faceless shadow, good to ride by the people who have been abandoned and forgotten, like he and his father once had.
Chapter 9.
At first, it was just Matt. It was just Matt wearing black exercise clothes to blend into the night. It was only Matt, his fists and his body. It was only Matt. No weapons, no technology. He didn't need technology, and if Stick had taught him one thing, it was that his body was all the weapon he needed. Matt didn't carry weapons, didn't carry knives or gun or explosives. He was the weapon. He was the devil in his soul, the devil in his mind that screamed for more and more and more. At first, it was enough to go out once a week. He went to Fogwell to train with a few of the men who had been his family once upon a time. Then after, instead of going home, back to the dorm, he put on a mask and followed the screams. The screams of the innocent who were being hurt, innocent voices of people, more often than not women or children, who were hurt and abused, who were in danger, who were scared and were screaming for help that wouldn't come. The screams of the devil inside him drove him for more and more and more and more. Soon it wasn't enough anymore to go once a week. Matt knew that people needed someone to protect them, needed him, needed the devil, more than once a week. He knew that for every innocent soul he saved on the one day he went out, six more were hurt and left defenceless and alone on the other days. Matt knew he had a power. He had a responsibility to those people. So he started going out every other day. He knew he had to keep days of rest, days to recover from the hits he would inevitably take, and days to keep his facade up. He was just a blind law student, after all. He was just the guy who went to practice at his old father's gym once a week. Foggy didn't know. Foggy's friends, his family, all the innocent people in Matt's life didn't know. Matt had to keep it that way. He had to keep them safe and protected. So Matt kept his life during the day and the devil separate. He didn't tell anyone about the devil. He came up with excuses about where he went, sooner or later every night. Or where he got the bruises, contusions, and the occasional cut or abrasion. Where he misjudged a blow and got hit. He kept his life as Matt Murdock upright. He went to classes and study groups, did his homework and wrote essays for assignments. Matt spent his evenings with Foggy, went out for a drink with him every now and again to keep him from suspecting. But every night, once Foggy was asleep or when he was out with friends or over at Marcy's for drinks, Matt let the devil out. He changed from his casual clothes into simple black exercise clothes, studied combat boots, packed his gloves and mask. To anyone he met on campus, he looked like nothing more than an insomniac student. He used the quiet hours of the night for some exercise that didn't fit into a packed schedule during the day. And Matt paid attention to not come across anyone who might recognise him, even in the cover of darkness. As soon as he was out of range of the dorms and the many bars that were frequented by students, he masked up, climbed onto a rooftop overlooking most of his hearing range, and focused. It never took long for the first screams to echo off the many tall buildings, and echo the screams in his heart, mind and soul. Every night, at every scream and every victim he could save, Matt fought. It was always the same. Fists up, head down. Fight, hit, kick. Fight, defeat the monsters that made the city unsafe for the innocent. Fight, go down, get back up. Fight, win, move on. To the next scream, to the next monster who needs a warning and a punishment. It was always the same. Until it wasn't.
Chapter 10. Fist up, head down, keep fighting. Focus on the ring, focus on the ropes at your back. It is just you and your opponent. It is just the devil and an enemy. Grievous harm is the only answer. The law could only help so far. The law had failed too many times. He had tried. God, he had tried. He had prayed. He had held his trust in the system. He had watched as the system failed so many. words could only help too far. Fight. Fight for their lives. Nobody else is coming to save you. Nobody else can. It was him, the devil. It was him, Jack's boy. A devil for which hell had tried too many times to claim. A soul which heaven would continue to fight for. The scales of justice teetered over his heart. Fists up, head down. It's him against the world, a brick wall against his back. An enemy down the alley. He had not lost yet. Matt may have been battered and bruised and broken so very many times, but a Murdoch always gets up. A Murdoch never gives up. Even if it cost them their life. Even if it cost them the future they should have had. Fight. Nobody else will. Nobody else will defeat this enemy. They would, if you had only asked for help. Blow after blow after blow. Punch, duck, kick. Fight. Never give up, never give in. The enemy are fond of him deserved this. At this time of night, couldn't remember the exact crime, the exact reasoning, but he did not deserve to be as happy as he was. Had hurt and broken too much, too many. Evil didn't always look or sound like evil. Too many people would believe this person in front of Matt to be good. They were not. They were so not. They deserved to be hurt. In this corner, the daredevil, the man without fear. In the opposite, an unnamed enemy, yet another one for the devil to defeat. The wall behind his back replaced the ropes of the ring. It was not a fair fight. There were more of them, but the others seemed to at least be keeping a step back. They formed the fourth wall at the end of the alleyway, seemingly trusting in their leader's ability to defeat the devil. It could be a fair fight, one versus one. No referee, but his father's voice in one ear and sticks in the other. Never give up. Let the devil out. It can save you. It can hurt you. His gloved hands landed against the enemy, leather against flesh and fabric, the harsh breathing of an enemy determined not to give up. The fighter, the enemy in front of him, was younger, faster. But Matt was more experienced and fueled by pure anger at this moment. This fight couldn't be counted in rounds, but they matched every blow the other one threw, matched every missed shot and ducked fist. There was a conversation happening in the audience, in the watchers, in the voices at the end of the alleyway, about stepping in, about helping, and Matt wanted to growl at them, to be quiet, to respect the fight, to let it happen. He had to focus, though he couldn't be downed. He stumbled to the ground, swinging back to his feet in a fluid motion, spitting blood across the alleyway. He was sure he was bruises galore in the morning. The scent of iron from broken skin, a patchwork of evidence of this fight. Murdochs always get up. Despite everything, they get back up. Matt circled like a caged animal, his breathing fast and ragged, and in this ring, he would not be granted the respect of a break. Adrenaline was all that fueled him to continue. To ignore the warning signs of his body, the pain and exhaustion. A blow to his face pushed him against the wall, a smack as he bounced off of it, and the world waited out for a second before he came back, gasping for breath. There's a stutter of a pause from his enemy before they continue to fight. It was clear by now that this was a fight to knock out, that neither was going to concede. It was a true ring, Matt would have never had the points to win. In a street fight, it was clear that the only way they would be leaving would be if the other was unconscious, or at least down beyond being able to chase. Vicious, merciless punches helped Matt to corner his enemy, a growl as he took control of the ring, as he ignored every part of his body which was screaming out in pain. He was better. He had been trained for this. He had grown up with the fight. Somehow a punch to the gut took him by surprise, and he stepped back, and the animal was released from their corner. Another had him back up against the wall, and a third knocked him off his feet to hit the floor. He was suddenly hyper-aware of everything in his body. Everything outside of it was silenced. An ache in his skull where he'd hit the ground. The creaking of his ribs where more had just fractured from the fall. The smell of blood from the countless cuts. A heart that didn't beat in its familiar rhythm. It started irregularly, strained to return to normal. And his breath gasped out of his lungs and refused to return. until his heart and lungs simply gave up. The enemies fled. Nobody checked. Nobody attempted CPR. But even if they had, it would have been too late. The devil had given up on its host. Perhaps it knew, in some sick, twisted sense of fate, that this was the night another Murdoch had lost his final fight. That this was always meant to be. A boxing ring by another name, a grave across a cemetery that shared the last name now left extinct. The world found Matthew Murdoch, dead, abandoned in an alleyway, a fight gone wrong.
Chapter 11. Foggy Nelson was sitting at a plain grave. The sight made the pain worse, the hole in his heart even bigger. There was no headstone. The ground wasn't settled enough to set it up yet. The grave was simply marked with a wooden cross. It was plain. There had been Matt's name and the plot number written on it when Foggy came back to the grave the day after the ceremony. But the bad weather of the last few days, Foggy wasn't even sure how long it had been, had washed it away. The rest of the grave was just as plain. There was no candle burning, no figurines or trinkets on the black dirt that covered the equally plain coffin. Foggy had meant to bring flowers, maybe a few decorations, something Matt would have liked, but he couldn't bring himself to even enter the small store that was located by the entrance of the graveyard. There were a lot of things Foggy couldn't bring himself to do. He couldn't bring himself to take tactile markers off the jars and cartons in their kitchen box. He couldn't bring himself to pack up Matt's toiletries in the bathroom. He didn't use them. Matt hadn't liked it when he did. He once, as they were drunk and stumbling home after a long party, said he preferred it when Foggy smelt like his own soap and shampoo. Foggy couldn't get himself to change a thing about the small dorm room they had shared. He'd kept one of Matt's shirts, had hidden it from the nuns when they came to collect Matt's belongings. They were his next of kin, technically. Yet another thing that hurt to think about. The fact that the orphanage had been the place that Matt had always hated the most, but that the people were the only thing that even just remotely resembled family to him, at least in one aspect of the word. Foggy stood at the edge of the grave for a while, simply staring at the black dirt. He didn't know why he came here every day. He had never been a person to go to the cemetery when he missed the people in his life who were no longer there. He wasn't even sure he could find his grandfather's grave on his own. His family had always simply remembered him in a different way. But for Matt, he was drawn to the grave. He was drawn to this place, maybe in a similar way that Matt had been drawn back to Clinton Church. Being there was painful. It brought back all the dark and painful emotions that he had, more or less, under control, when he was at home, in class, studying. Being here hurt. It reminded him of Matt, of every aspect of his best friend. But at the same time, there was a sort of serenity to it. It was peaceful here. Quiet. Matt had liked the quiet. He never talked much about it, but it was impossible to miss, after years of living together, that he was always most relaxed in the early hours of the night, when the dorm around them quietened down. Foggy didn't know how long he had been standing there, staring at the grave of his best friend, the person he had loved most in this world, and disassociated from the world around him, when a nun approached him, or rather the grave he was standing at. At first, Foggy didn't pay her much attention, simply expected her to walk past, go to one of the many graves around him that were covered in flowers or lovingly decorated. And even when she stopped next to him, at a polite distance but still clearly looking down at the same plot, it took Foggy a moment to realise she was here for Matt. When he looked up, not sure what to say and not even sure he would get words out if he had, he recognised the woman as one of the nuns who had been at the funeral. "You were his friend, right?" she asked. Her voice was quiet and a little weak, and Foggy could clearly hear the grief in it. "Yes," he answered simply. "We lived together, since our first semester at Columbia." "Your speech was very nice," she added, after another moment of silence. "It is obvious you knew him very well." "He was my best friend," Foggy brought out.
his voice breaking a little as tears were welling up in him again. "I'm glad he had someone who cared about him as much as you did," the nun said, her voice betraying that she was equally close to tears as Foggy. It took Foggy a long time to find it in him to talk again. The words were stuck in his throat, the tears threatening to spill at the sheer thought of speaking them out loud. "You work at the orphanage, right?" he asked finally, looking over the shorter woman for a moment, before turning his eyes back to Matt's final resting place at their feet. "You knew Matt since he was a child?" "Yes," she nodded, just at the edge of Foggy's vision, not looking up from the grave for more than a few seconds either. She sighed, and then trailed off. Foggy didn't know why. Matt had never spoken highly about any of the nuns at St. Agnes, and from what little he had shared, this feeling was mutual, so this reaction was unexpected, even if not entirely surprising. But it seemed like this nun was just as broken by losing Matt as Foggy was. They spent several minutes in silence before the nun spoke again. "I knew his dad, Battling Jack. We met before Matt was born. Before I took my vows and became who I am today." Foggy nodded, humming a wordless but clearly audible agreement with it. It was automatic, at this point, to narrate gestures and describe details of his surroundings that would otherwise be lost to Matt. "He was a good boy, Matt was." The nun, Foggy realised she'd never introduced herself, continued. "He always got himself into trouble, but he had a good soul." A weak half-smile tucked at the corner of Foggy's mouth. He could imagine that, could see Matt getting in trouble over anything and everything. He was, had been, stubborn like that. He didn't know what to answer. Foggy's mind kept wandering when he was here, wandering to all the things he knew about Matt, all the things he'd stood for, and all the memories Foggy hoped he could keep forever. Foggy and the nun stood in silence for a long time, until Foggy remembered that he had come here to tell Matt something. "I got a letter," Foggy said, more addressing the cold, wet dirt by his feet than the woman standing a few feet away by his side. "Or, well, I guess Matt technically got a letter. But it was sent to the dorm, and it's from Columbia, so I opened it." He had to clear his throat, wrap his arms around himself for some sort of comfort. Matt got honoured by the school. They wrote a whole letter and everything about how he was a choice student of Columbia, about how he was a prime example of why it's important to sponsor promising minds and all that. The nun didn't say anything tangible, but when she nodded, she accompanied it with a soft hum, a sound that reminded Foggy of his own. They wrote about him being top of his class in almost every course, and about how he would have passed everything we had left with flying colours. Foggy added, nudging a small rock away from the edge of Matt's grave absently. They awarded him with his law degree posthumously. Foggy sighed. It felt all wrong, all too little and too late. Summa cum laude.